Hello again, everybody. Time for the Mainland Podcast. I am Michael Citro, Managing Editor from themainland.com. This is episode number 67, and we're very pleased to have a very special guest as we head toward the Orlando City B playoff game this weekend. But before we get to him, of course, we have to talk about a whole bunch of other things. And joining me to do just that, Andrew Harrison is back in the house after a week off. Andrew, how's it going, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well. I've hoped we'd have some more positive news to report on after my week off, but here we stand.
And, of course, two games since we last spoke, and neither one of them was a win. But I don't think either of us saw such a lopsided loss coming at DC United.
No, we couldn't have predicted that it was going to be such a one-sided affair. We knew that DC would be up for it. They were streaking a little bit, but I don't think anybody could have predicted a 4-1 blowout.
Yeah, another 4-1 blowout. And in fact, that was the
trio.
third consecutive game in which the Lions shipped four goals, which had never happened before previously. They did give up 5-4 in back-to-back games last year in August under Adrian Heath. But this kind of came out of nowhere because the team had been playing well, then went out to L.A. and honestly could have had more goals against L.A. and lost 4-2 on basically on just some failures to track back and getting beat over the top largely. Plus it's L.A. They're tough at home. It's a good team. A lot of that could have been written off. But then you come home and you lose 4-1 to Columbus Crew, one of the worst teams in MLS this year, although they have an MLS Cup final pedigree from last year. And then, you know, you figure, okay, well, maybe it's just tired legs coming back cross country. You know, they're really going to be up for DC United. And they really didn't seem to be all that up for DC United. Some chances early that maybe could have changed the momentum of the game. There was a chance early for Kyle Larin, who inexplicably tried to play it with his foot when he could have maybe a diving header would have gotten the ball home and gotten the Lions an early lead. But it was DC United 1-0 at the half. And as we've seen over a couple of games, did not respond well after halftime. And DC put a couple more in the net and basically put that game away. A really nice moment late in the game for second half sub Julio Baptista, who maybe one of the goals of the season for Orlando City with his free kick from just above the box, banging it in off the crossbar. But then, you know, giving up the first MLS goal to a player late is just not good. I mean, they weren't never able to get that second goal. Came close, but it was basically just a butt kicking at DC.
Yeah, we never looked in the game. Christ was unable to make any tactical or any substitutions that kind of brought any life into the game. Obviously, Julio Baptista came on and scored, but that was really one bright moment in such a dark, dark game. There was just no positivity. The defense, even though we were back to what had been as such a good partnership in Arjan Mateos, just completely looked at sixes and sevens. We were also just, you know, once again, we had Ambrose starting as well. Maybe there was a little bit of a weakness because he's not quite there at that level, but it comes with playing with this team. But also you can't tar and feather him too much because this defense has shipped a lot of goals this season when he hasn't been on the field. The partnership just didn't seem to really be working anywhere. We thought this was going to be our lineup. This was a lineup where we had kind of got everything back on track before we lost to LA. And it was just a train wreck. There's no real better way to describe it. No, there was no positivity. Kyle Larin looked completely lost up front. The early substitutions of both him and Kaká kind of, you knew Christ was just giving it away and hoping that he'd then be able to take two fresh, at least slightly fresher talisman up to Toronto. But as we'll get to that, that didn't necessarily work out either. It's hard to say. I mean, even this time, Bendik didn't have any positivity because he just couldn't stand on his head tonight on that game.
Yeah, it didn't get any easier when Antonio Nocerino was sent off, you know, with the elbow. It's one of those plays that happens 10 times a game in a soccer game, and you know, it sometimes gets caught, sometimes doesn't. He was a little too obvious on that one,
Yeah.
and as a result, he had to miss the Toronto match, and of course, it really put the clamps on Orlando City as far as being able to come back in that game. You mentioned Mikey Ambrose. He had a teachable moment on the Lloyd Sam goal. Lloyd Sam attacked the ball in the air, and Mikey Ambrose waited on the ball and let the ball come to him. I think that he was positionally fine. He just didn't attack the ball in the air the way Lloyd Sam did. And again, I think that's something that Jason Christ can use as a teachable moment for him. And I think he'll be a better player for having made that mistake. I at least I hope so, because you learn more from your losses and your mistakes than you do from your victories and your successes. So, or at least that's what they tell me. I haven't had a whole lot of successes, so I couldn't tell
I was going to say, at what point
you.
do we learn the lesson and pass?
Yeah, it's, I guess it's a more forgivable error for a guy like Mikey Ambrose than it would be for a Bowden or a Breck Shea at left back, or on the other side, Alston or Ramos, guys who have been around in the MLS for a while.
I mean, that's it. I don't want, he's really young. He's really just trying to fit into. I mean, let's be honest. He wasn't even really in the mindset, I don't think, before Christ came along and realized that he needed more people on the back line. Heath was probably just going to continue to band-aid over the cracks until he could potentially get to the off season and restructure. He came up. He's done well. He's been another body to be able to switch out Bowden, because the system of wing backs, you can't play all 32 games. You will not be effective in quite a lot of those if you're playing week in, week out, especially when you get to the crunch side. And with Orlando taking the FIFA breaks off this year, we've had an even more compacted schedule. So bodies have been needed. Hopefully he will be able to learn. I think that Christ is willing to teach people to learn, but he's still got a long way to go.
Sure. And you know, as far as man of the match goes, I don't think that many Lions had a good game. So I gave Baptista my man of the match because, you know, he at least did one positive thing, and I didn't see a lot of players doing one positive thing that night.
Yeah, I mean, even our go-to recently of MPG had been playing well, Bendik had been playing well. Baptista got mine too, because it was just he was the only one who played with any positivity when he came on, and he was able to get a great goal. I would imagine it's probably going to be our goal of the month as a site. But it's really sad that you have to get man of the match by being the only person who tries.
Yeah, it's and you know, with the team not coming home and going on to Toronto from there, I didn't have a good feeling about after giving up four goals in a row, or four goals, three games in a row. I didn't have a good feeling going into Toronto, where they had a red hot Jozy Altidore, where Orlando City had lost by a combined 9-1 in two games last year at BMO Field. I didn't think that that was going to be a very good result. I thought 4-0, maybe 4-1 again. And I, you know, and I predicted that. That was, you know, one of my predictions was that the team wasn't going to do very well against Toronto. And you know, they go up there and they actually did quite well. In fact, granted, they didn't score a goal, but I thought, and I do think that after three straight games of giving up four goals, to be able to hold a team like Toronto with some very prolific scorers off the score sheet, yes, they had some chances, but they're always going to have good chances. They're Toronto. With the players they have, they're always going to generate something. I thought to get a clean sheet was a very big positive step. Of course, the problem with that is that the team was had a man advantage for the last 20 minutes. So you would hope that they could maybe get a goal, and maybe if had they been at home, maybe they could have fought through for that goal. I didn't see a lot of legs left on that team late in that game, and just weren't able to quite do it. They had a good chance fairly early on with a cross from Breck Shea that Molino couldn't get onto, but it fell for Laren, and Laren just didn't get enough power on it, and Bono was able to get down and make a save in the corner. early on. I thought the best chance maybe that we had the entire game was Kaká getting in, doing a nice job of beating two defenders, but then when he got in, he shot it right at Bono. So unfortunately, just too many wasted chances. Not a great game for Larin, who looks exhausted. We've said that before about him, and then he's gone out and scored a hat trick. So there's no telling what you're going to get out of him. But he's played a lot of football the last year and a half. And I don't know. I just thought that a nil-nil result actually would not have been a bad result had DC United not gotten all 3 points yesterday.
I mean, I think, how about this? If we hadn't lost the previous three games, four plus something, we would have considered this a win. You're going
Oh,
into
yeah.
a really strong defensive Toronto team that has just gotten so much better. They picked up Bedarfsh for Vancouver. They picked up Drumoer from Colorado. They've looked really stout in the back line. You've also got Bono, who is really their second string goalkeeper, but he's been playing excellent and kept Clint Irwin out at the side. And then you just move forward and you've got Altidore, Bradley, and Giovinco. Giovinco was obviously missing, but Bradley was so great at managing to eliminate Kaká out of the game. He just stuck to him like glue all the time, and it made it really difficult for Kaká to be able to get free. And even when we were playing the 4-4-2 formation, we still looked too compressed and narrow because Bradley was just doing such a great job of holding everybody in check. Overall, I thought it was a pretty good performance. I don't want to say it was a great performance because I think this team is capable of so much more. But this was a team that had gone out with the remit that they needed to win, and they never looked capable of winning. And that's maybe's on the coach a little bit, and then you got to get people a little bit more buoyed up. But I like the change in formation. It just unfortunately didn't pan out, and you can't expect a team that has been playing the same formation for almost 2 years to just come out and be able to snap it into place.
I kind of wonder who would have been that protector of the back line in the back of the diamond if Nocerino was not suspended for the game, because I thought Carrasco was okay. I didn't think he was great, but certainly that was something that intrigued me when I saw the lineup was oh wow, we're finally going to see the 4-4-2 diamond from Jason Christ that we've been hearing for a long time, and the fact that he was starting Larin and Rivas together up top kind of that was intriguing as well, and I thought this could be really an interesting game. And I did think that they that this that the concept was sound of having Molino and Brekschei on the wings, guys that are willing to run, maybe Shea more than Molino, especially tracking back. But then Kaká at the top of the diamond, you've essentially got with him and Rivas and Larin, you've got three guys who can threaten the defense. Maybe it will keep the fullbacks from bombing forward, because the fullbacks really have torn up Orlando City the last few games during the 3-game losing streak. And so it was a sound concept, and I thought that Rivas started off okay, but he's one of those guys that I think he can turn a game in any given moment, and if you give him an opportunity. But once Toronto got into the game and started seeing more of the ball in the midfield, Kreis had no real choice but to make a tactical change. Otherwise, they were going to concede a goal. And I hear a lot of people saying, "Well, why didn't he wait till halftime?" Well, if he concedes in the 43rd minute, should then everybody's complaining. Well, if he saw the problem, why didn't he change it? So I thought he did. I had no problem with what he did. Yes, they have to manage Carlos Rivas and make sure he knows this isn't on you. This is not why we made the change. It wasn't because you were playing badly or that we don't, value you or anything like that. You have to massage him a little bit. He's a young player and he's going to take that hard. But hopefully he'll take it the right way, because they didn't do it because of him. They did it because they wanted to get Higuita on and shore up that midfield and start winning some of those battles and stop giving so many gaps to Toronto runners. And I thought that, in a lot of ways, I thought that that tactical move worked. There were still some breakdowns, but not nearly as many as we were seeing. But again, I think the old saying is that if something must be done, then it should be done as soon as possible.
Yep.
It's the same sort of concept that Orlando City used when firing Adrian Heath. It's like, mm-hmm. if they felt they needed to do it, then they needed to do it as soon as they could. And the same thing was holds true with taking Rivas off is, you know, you don't wait. If you see a tactical area where you're being outplayed and outmaneuvered, you have to shore that up as soon as you can. You can't just wait 5 more minutes and hope they don't score.
Well, I think it was a case of the dam eventually breaking if they didn't make that change. Mm-hmm. As you said, Carrasco was, you know, he's kind of really started there out of necessity a little bit. I think you're right. And Nocerino starts at the base of that diamond if he's available. And he chooses to switch to that. But I thought Carrasco, the one thing you can never knock about Carrasco is his engine. He does mm-hmm. continuously run for 90 minutes. The problem is sometimes he's not running effectively to be able to break something down, or he makes a rash challenge and he concedes mm-hmm. that free kick. But the problem was he was not able to cope with Delgado and Osorio and a Cooper trying to keep them in check by himself. And mm-hmm. when you have two people who are kind of loath to track back in Molino and Rivas, all of a sudden you're leaving them completely exposed. And so Christ was right to make that change. It is going to be interesting to see how they manage him, because he did throw his toys out of the pram a little bit when he was coming off the field, because he thought it was him. He wanted that more of an opportunity. But
yeah,
if we go in 1-0 at halftime, we do not come out of this game with any points. And Christ knew that. He was playing the odds, and he just had to hope that DC didn't get such an emphatic win and that Montreal didn't win. Unfortunately, both of those went against him, and mm-hmm. the job's going to be that little bit harder. But do we see the diamond again? I think we do, but maybe we see Nocerino basing that out. And I think you have to consider bringing in Perez Garcia again, because he's just been dangerous in the games where he's been able to be effective.
Well, I know we'll see MPG on Sunday, because Breck Shea got himself another yellow card for no apparent reason. This is a thing that drives me insane, is that the suspensions for no reason and the yellow cards that build up because you do 4 or 5 dumb things rather than a tactical foul, which is something that you have to do to help the team. You take a silly yellow, really, for no reason. I mean, he slipped a little on the play and got a shoulder in the face, and he probably felt like he was fouled. But if he hadn't slipped, that would have never happened. He would have never got hit in the face, and I'm sure he got up a little hot, a little angry, maybe a little embarrassed, and then he yapped at the official about it, and he got himself a yellow for absolutely no reason. So Breck Shea is out on Sunday against Montreal in a game that the Lions must win, and you know, they won't have one of their attacking options now because of him. So a selfish play, a dumb play, and you know, I'm sure he would. You know, you could call me out for calling him that, but I mean, I'm sure even Breck would agree at this point, now that he's cooled down, that it was a dumb play and a selfish play, and he shouldn't have done it. So, you know, Nocerino had one of those the game before. Yeah. I mean, he was trying to give a little extra, you know, while the ball was in the air, and a lot of times you're going to get away with that, but in that particular instance, he didn't. But those are the kinds of plays that need to be stamped out. And if these players are incapable of stopping themselves from making those kinds of plays, then you got to get new players, because you can't keep living with those kind of mistakes.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we've seen it. Is this the third or fourth time from Breck now? Like, and there was a point where if he was going to keep mouthing off, you know, he could have kept going, and you could have seen something. And later on in the game, he made a fairly ill-timed challenge and could have easily seen a second yellow. This is something that we've talked about with this team a lot, is temperament. Ramos has the same problem. Breck Shea seems to be on the field a little more this season, so we've been seeing it a little more. We've got to do it. It's not always going to go right, but that doesn't mean that you get to be upset about it. Yeah, the ref's going to stink occasionally, or more often than not, you still have to just deal it. You're a professional. We're not playing in Sunday league anymore. You've got to be better, and that's how you win games.
Absolutely. And you know, I think we should probably go back at some point. Somebody on our staff should go back, look at all of Breck's yellow cards, and see how many of them were avoidable. Because I bet it's probably close to half.
I'd say pretty close. I know one of his sendings off was certainly avoidable.
Yeah. So anyway, it ended up in a 0-0 draw. It's a point. It's not what we wanted, but I mean, I think, as you said, because of the situation and because of the fact that Toussaint Ricketts got sent off in the 70th minute, you think it should be more than a draw. But I mean, Toronto is a very well-organized defensive team, and they were not letting anybody have any space. They were outnumbered by one, but if you put all of those 10 men behind the ball, it's very, very difficult to break down a good defensive team. In fact, Toronto is the exact model Orlando City should follow this offseason, with going out and finding the right pieces, the right experienced MLS pieces to put in the holes that they have. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. They went out and got a Betashore. They went out and got a Drew Moore. These are guys that have stepped in and been able to help. A Will Johnson, guys with experience in this league who are good, you know, not necessarily MLS All-Stars, but guys who are solid and know the league and, you know, are quality players. And I think that Orlando City needs to follow that blueprint this offseason, and hopefully we can get a couple of wins and push that offseason off for another week or two. Man of the match time for Toronto is a very difficult one. I thought Christian Higuita, when he came on in the 40th minute, did a very nice job of helping to stop some of the bleeding, winning balls in the midfield. He was a tackling machine, an intercepting machine, getting in people's way, doing a nice job of basically just gumming up the works a little bit. He would be a candidate, but I think I probably got to go with Bendik, even though he had a colossal mistake that he got away with early in the second half. He still made some nice saves and kept the team in the game and ultimately kept the clean sheet.
I'm not going to agree with you. I think just because of that mistake, and I think he got lucky more often than not sometimes. Like, I didn't necessarily feel that he always kept us in the game. It wasn't really a game of a lot of moments, but as much as I think Kaká didn't have a great game, he was my man of the match. I think he was at least trying to run at people. He was trying to potentially get it into the fact that, you know, if I can make something happen, then something will happen around me. And I think that was so important that night, because we had just been blown out so many times and we needed one person to step forward. And he was running at people. He wasn't always effective, but that was just because, once again, Bradley was marking him out of the game. And I think if he comes up against any other defensive midfielder, Kaká has a blowout kind of game.
Yeah, and that wasn't just Bradley. I mean, they were throwing in extra guys at him all over the pitch. I mean, Delgado and Cooper, Osorio, whoever was in the neighborhood was basically, I'm on Kaká as well as Bradley. Yep. So, you know, to his credit, he worked very hard all night. You know, it's a shame that he couldn't have had a better effort on goal in that time that he slipped in the second half, which was only a few minutes after the sending off. And, you know, the other thing that he does sometimes is he will dribble into trouble instead of, you know, thinking that he can get out of it. He doesn't always get out of it. And you know, that I'm sure irks some fans, because sometimes I get a little irritated with him holding on to the ball, thinking, you see them closing you down, buddy. Come on, you gotta get it out of there. But you know, he is who he is, and he's been successful throughout his career because he has made those plays and gotten by those guys when you thought he was trapped and cut off. So you got to live with a few of those every game. So I definitely don't disagree with your choice. So I thought that if I had to pick three guys that I thought, again, it wasn't a great game for anybody, not particularly a great game, but I thought the three top performances probably were definitely Higuita, Kaká, and Bendik. And in a shutout situation, I guess I err toward the goalkeeper, because he did make a few pretty nice saves. I forget who he stopped in the...
Yeah, he's going to win Save of the Week. I mean...
yeah. Another Save of the Week opportunity. Delgado had a good chance on him. And early, I thought he was very good. I definitely thought he had some slip-ups in the game. But I thought early in the game he was good and kept the team in the game. So, anyway, it's a draw. And we move on and hopefully can beat Montreal, unlike San Jose the other night. San Jose got another Wando out of Wando. He had a chance to tie the game and biffed it pretty badly. And then Montreal got a late goal to make it 3-1. But that could have been drop points for Montreal, but wasn't. We really can't expect any help from Columbus if they're playing DC United, and we didn't get any. That game was actually 0-0 for quite a while, and then it just kind of caved in on Columbus. So Montreal, Sunday afternoon, at the campground, and we'll see what happens without Breck Shea in the lineup. Okay, so we had an Orlando Pride finale over the weekend, Andrew.
Yep.
It didn't go very well, although once again, the Pride scored first on just a tremendous strike by Jasmine Spencer. A free kick from Kristen Edmonds hit the wall, fell for Spencer, and Spencer drilled it, just a laser blast. And it was 1-0 at the half. For the third consecutive game, the Pride had a 1-0 lead at halftime. And for the third consecutive game, they could not build on that, shipping two goals in the second half to FC Kansas City. And once Kansas City gets a lead on you, they are extremely tough with the players they have on the back line to break down. Very, very tough team to break down. So once they get a lead on you, they can kind of strangle you and take you out of the match, which is what they did.
Yeah, I thought the Pride had a pretty good first half. One player who I've been really impressed with was Lisa Devana. Her footwork and just her vision in the game is really exceptional. She played a really good part. It was a beautiful goal from Spencer, who was set up by her roommate and very good friend, Kristen Edmonds. It was a good partnership. I kind of thought, you know, I hadn't been to a game in a while. I was gonna be once again their good spark to getting out a win. but in the second half, it just kind of all changed. They lost a bit of their shape. They looked tired. And as you mentioned, Kansas City have such a defensive setup that getting another one was always going to be difficult. So when they scored, didn't look like we were going to have much of a chance to hold them off, and unfortunately we didn't. We kept knocking away, but as I turned to the person I was watching the game with, Becky Sauerbrunn's like having three center backs.
Yeah, yeah. She really marked Alex Morgan out of that game.
She truly did, and I actually... You don't see how well she necessarily plays on TV. You know she's a great player, but in person, she was just everywhere she needed to be. And it was almost like she was the only defender. And then you looked around, and it turns out she's got three other people helping her out. And it's unfortunate that the Pride have to go out this way. I think they would have really loved to have been able to get a home win to end the season, but it just wasn't to be.
You know, I asked Alex after the game about Becky Sauerbrunn. I asked her two questions back to back, and she gave me a very thorough answer to the first one, and then either chose not to or forgot to answer the question about Becky Sauerbrunn. But, you know, I think that she showed a lot of passion in the post game press conference in terms of wanting to build a winning team here. She said that, you know, the ownership promised her that they would do everything in their power to make this a winning team. And she was disappointed to be called away so many times for international duty. Not that she doesn't love to represent the country, but because she wanted to be on the field with her teammates. And you could really see that passion on her face and the disappointment and not having been here to do more to help the Pride this year. And it won't be as big a deal next year because there's no World Cup. There's no Olympics. So it won't be as much disruption to the NWSL season. You know, obviously Tom Sormani has to go out here in the off season now that the year's over, and you know, pick up some pieces to plug in and fill some holes, and not only fill some holes but provide depth for some of those players who may be called away from time to time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we kind of mentioned it too before, you know, just like Orlando City, he's got to go out and pick up those people that he's got to do, and it's going to be difficult. I mean, unfortunately, the Pride have had numerous retirements this year, as have everybody else. It's going to be interesting, but the college draft does have a little bit more potential coming in this offseason. There are names and good young talent to be had out there, but I do expect at least a 50% turnover in this roster.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what he does with the back line. He certainly had players that you would think would be capable of preventing goals with four internationals along the back line. For whatever reason, the back line never really worked as a unit from about the midseason on. They sort of had a good start to the year, but they from about the midpoint on, you could get at them over the top or with through balls. And that was something that, you know, possibly is tactical awareness in the midfield partially, and partially some, you know, just because of so many different lineups having to be used and that kind of thing. But, you know, I think overall a fairly successful expansion season for the Pride. They beat the Houston Dash's number of wins, I believe, fairly early on before they sort of went into that skid at the end of the year. And of course, you know, the attendance record to start the season was nice too. So, you know, a positive year, a lot they can build on. I think that, you know, you mentioned retirements. Becky Edwards played her last game, and that was a pretty emotional scene on the weekend with her coming off and talking to her after the game. And one thing that probably isn't being reported as much as it should is that Becky Edwards and Kristen Edmonds. Edwards and Edmonds came over in a trade for Orlando City's first round pick in the next draft. So Orlando City doesn't have a first round pick right now. Or I'm sorry, the Orlando Pride doesn't have a first round pick right now.
You know, the problem, and that's the danger that I think this front office has run across on the men's and the women's team, is they've given up a lot of draft talent. They've kind of draft choices. They've kind of decided that that's not the way they want to go. And unfortunately, that's becoming more prevalent. You know, we're talking about that. We thought that maybe there was going to be elimination of the expansion draft. So that was going to be a mechanism that disappeared. We haven't had a lot of success out of the college draft, you could argue, this year in terms of the men's team. Larea and Barry haven't really added anything to the main men's side. They've added some good minutes occasionally for OCB. I think this team has just decided that what they want to do is be able to go out and know that the second year they're going to have to stack with talent, and you're going to have to stack with people who have NWSL game experience, and therefore it's going to be okay to give away the draft for this year.
And it's very difficult to find players in the NWSL, because with the wages they pay those players, it's very, very difficult for them to make a living. And we see these women retiring at a young age when they're still in their prime, because they find a job that mm-hmm. actually pays them quite a bit of money. And, you know, it's when you have a, you know, you have a family and you have people that you love, you want to take care of, you know, sometimes that can make you make those types of decisions. It's unfortunate, but the fact that the NWSL has survived four seasons is a good sign, but it's not, we're not there yet. We're not to the point where this league can really be called a success. It can only be called, you know, the most successful so far.
Yeah. And that's a shame, because I think that that's had a really good year, but let's be honest, we've also had some bad takeaways from this season. The NWSL game for the Western New York Flash on the Lilliputian-sized pitch. There's also bad. Been some comments from certain owners that haven't gone down well, and just the lack of communication from the league office, I think, is really what's starting to hinder this league more than anything, because you do have such a vocal national women's base that when you have a inactive front office, but you have such a vocal player group, you're going to always have that mix. And in will it's, I think it's going to prosper next year. But what they have to do is they have to go through the CBA this off season for the women's team nationally. That's probably going to potentially affect NWSL if they decide to get rid of the requirement that U.S. women's players have to play in NWSL. There are going to be some moving parts, but the league probably doesn't survive if they remove that requirement. So it's going to be an interesting off season, to say the least.
Yeah, the league could use some influx of cash through sponsorship and television rights and that kind of thing. That can help the league because that will help these teams be able to spend more money on players. And that is the lifeblood of the league is players.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to take care of them. And right now, only the cream of the crop are really being taken care of in NWSL. But anyway, the Pride finish at with 6 wins, 13 losses, and a draw, 19 points in ninth place out of the 10 teams ahead of the Boston Breakers. It was a team that really at midseason was battling Western New York Flash and Seattle Reign for the last playoff spot. So I guess you'd say the Pride were certainly hurt more than most other teams when it came to the international break and then the Olympic break, because not only, yes, the league shut down for 3 weeks, but the players left so early for those
Those
national
camps.
teams, yeah, that for the pre-Olympic camps, that you still lost them for a few games on the front side, and then it took you a while after the Olympics to get them back for the backside. So you still had those absences, and they still affected the team. And on top of that, the Pride already wasn't a very deep team, and then having an injury here or there, and a knock to Sarah Hagen had a concussion at one point, and there were other injuries here and there that kept some people out of the lineup, and it was just a revolving door, and that's just not a recipe for success. Having your having three NWSL rookies on the field at the same time is not an ideal situation unless they're absolute game changers. And although I thought Sam Wiedemann looked like a solid player who's got a good future, I don't think she was necessarily a game breaker type. Danny Weatherholt seems like she might be a useful role player down the road. She obviously also wasn't a game breaker type, and Christina Birkenrode sort of barely made it onto the team in the midseason. So, and she wasn't much in the much of a factor this year. So, when you've got those three rookies all taking up starting spots and being in the lineup at the same time, it's difficult to get results. And with Alex Morgan missing, there was not a threat that would occupy multiple defenders and allow the other players to prosper either. So there was a lot going on, and kudos to Tom Sormani for keeping the team together. They never quit. They always played hard, for 90 minutes, and it was good to see that. And I'm sure he'll go out and do some good things in the off season to bolster the team. One thing that's very exciting also, Andrew, is that the team will be moving into the new soccer stadium next year, so it won't seem like they're in this cavernous empty stadium. So even if they only draw 7, 8, 9,000, it's going to feel and look a lot better, and that's going to help the atmosphere, and that's going to help the players on the field.
Yeah, I mean, home is your castle kind of thing, and if they'd been able to if they'd been able to hold on the other day and get that feeling on just anything from home games where they just seem to be able to collapse in the second half, we would be further up the table. Maybe we would have been able to continue that playoff run, but I think we have to go into next season fresh. There's going to be a few reduced games, no tournaments. That should bring the crowd, the attendance, and also make this franchise successful in the second season, because Somani knows how to manage this league and he will know how to get the right talent that he needs.
Absolutely. Well, so it's off season for the women. We've got the NWSL playoffs. Meg put together a preview, playoff preview, and predictions, which is a nice piece over at the Mainland. You can read that, and she'll tell you who she thinks is going to move on to the final. Let's turn our attention to Orlando City B, because out of the weekend, they were the most successful team. They entered on the longest winless streak and came out. Actually, I think they were right there with the Pride. I think that was pretty close. And they had to have a win because Wilmington won Saturday night. So they knew that a draw or a loss had them out of the playoffs. And the Young Lions went up to Bethlehem. Played the Steel, which not a playoff team. They had nothing to play for, but I thought they played very, very hard in trying to win their home finale for their home fans, and they really gave Orlando City B everything they could handle. OCB got an early goal against the run of play off a nice long ball that Michael Cox was able to track down and get onto, and fought off two players to slide the ball across the 6 yard box, and Johnny Mendoza was able to get on that early and make it 1-0. From that point on, you thought maybe They're going to go out and win this thing. Bethlehem, again, they're behind. They got nothing to play for. Maybe they just call it a day, but they really came on strong at that point. Orlando City B was on the back heel for most of the game until a wonder strike by Lewis Neal made it 2-0 in the second half. And it was just one of those weird plays where the defender tried to clear it and mishit the ball. It ended up popping up in the air, chested down by Lewis, and he blasted it in. Huge goal. But Orlando City B still had, you know, some time on the clock, and that two-goal lead is always the most dangerous one in soccer, they say. So there were some nervy moments down the stretch. Mark Ridgers played fantastic in goal for Orlando City B. I thought that Zach Hayden on the left at left fullback played fantastic. And I thought that the guys hustled and played hard. They didn't always play very coherently as a team, but they did just enough to get the win and to propel themselves into the USL playoffs. So Orlando City has never missed the USL playoffs when they have competed in USL.
I mean, that's a great statistic, and the performance kind of showed you how much that meant. And I think the players wanted to go out and do it for themselves, but they also wanted to do it for what's been a very historic USL franchise, even though it's coming back from a hiatus, but also to do it for a first-year coach and Anthony Pulis. It was really that kind of performance that was, we control our own destiny. You know, so we're going to throw everything at the kitchen sink and we're going to hope that something breaks for us. It did. Obviously, we haven't played really well defensively, so it was always kind of teetering on the brink. It was kind of batting down the hatches, park the bus kind of defending at times. But once again, Ridges has had a pretty good season. I mean, he's really, as much as I thought we might see Edward get some minute this year, we haven't seen anything from Sturridge Ha get any really minutes either, because Ridges has just been playing so well and such a vital, important part for that team. Overall, a performance that isn't going to go down in history other than for the fact that it managed to get OCB into the playoffs, which was this franchise's goal at the start of the season. And it's nice that we were able to set a goal and make it, because we haven't had that for some other teams right now.
So OCB sneaks into the playoffs. They're the last team to get in, the lowest point total of any of the teams. So as long as they stay in the playoffs, they'll stay on the road. So Orlando City B, if they're going to win a trophy this year, they're going to have to do it the hard way. Starting out this weekend, Sunday, against New York Red Bulls 2, a team that beat them 5-1 in the last meeting, although Orlando City B went down a man early and ended up on 9 men before the game was out. But Orlando City B did play very well when New York Red Bulls 2 came to Melbourne, and they got a draw out of that game, a game that they largely, I thought, outplayed the visitors. But New York Red Bulls at that point weren't hitting on all cylinders, I don't think, yet. That was, I think, before they overtook Louisville City for the top team in the league. So, you know, maybe they caught them at a good time. Maybe you could say that. But there's a lot of talent there. And one thing is for sure, Orlando City B will not be facing a ferocious crowd at Red Bull Arena, one of the worst teams in the league at drawing in Harrison, New Jersey. But Orlando City needs to go in with some confidence, hopefully. They have no pressure at all, Andrew, because this team is not expected by anybody to win this game.
No, and it's sometimes a good place for us to be, but, you know, we didn't expect to get anything out of Cincinnati, but we had a really great game, and I think so. That's the kind of mindset that we need to go into. We finished on 35 points. The Red Bulls finished on 69 points. This is like,
that's a little better. Yeah.
This is a game that OCB is not expected to win. I think you could probably get good odds on a victory for Orlando City B if you really wanted to throw your money away. And that's sometimes where we prosper. You know, Rochester did it last year. You occasionally just have to be the people low down. You've got to go on and say, this is our mantle. This is our piece. We're going to have to go away from home wherever we go. So let's start it right. Let's get the mindset going and just play how we know we can. And hopefully we'll get some performances from the people that matter. Da Silva, Lewis Neal, Mark Ridges, and maybe our college draft picks will step up too.
Yeah, we got to get a good game out of Michael Cox as well, and whoever plays center back. Obviously, Tommy Redding was loaned to OCB to help get that win in Bethlehem, and I thought he played pretty well considering that he doesn't, he doesn't have a lot of experience playing with the teammates that he was playing with on Sunday. But it will be interesting to see if they can do it with Kyle McFadden and Connor Donovan or Devron Garcia, whoever they end up plugging into that center back pairing. But Anthony Pulis has done a good job of keeping the team together through a pretty long slide, and they managed to come together. It's good to see that. But instead of us just yammering about OCB, well, let's bring in our guest Lewis Neal, and we'll let him yammer about OCB with us for a while. We'll do that right after this. All right, joining us this week on the Mainland Podcast, very happy to have with us the captain of Orlando City B and, a coach on the field, Lewis Neal, former Orlando City MLS Lion and USL Lion. Lewis, how are you tonight?
Yes, I'm very good, guys. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You know, it's pretty exciting that Orlando City B was able to win that must-win game in Bethlehem, the final game of the season, and get into the playoffs. I want to, before we get into the postseason, I want to kind of go back to the winless streak and after a nice long 9-game unbeaten streak, and I want to just ask you what the impact of losing Tony Rocha and Mikey Ambrose to the senior team had on that skid, and sort of what else might have been contributing to the loss of form after such a good run.
Yeah, well, obviously, losing Tony and Mikey was always going to be hard to swallow. But obviously, that's what the team's built for. That's what the idea of the Orlando City B is, to get guys and progress them on into the first team. And obviously, being its first year in existence and the way that works, to have two guys go up to MLS like that is obviously, it's fantastic. It's a great achievement for everybody, involved with OCB and obviously Orlando City. So obviously that was great. Yes, they were a huge loss for us because they were, a very integral part of our team. But like I said, that's the purpose of the team, and they're the situations that we knew that we were going to have to deal with and we had to deal with. And obviously the 7-game losing streak was obviously very tough. I think we missed them a lot more than what we probably thought we was going to miss them. We thought, guys would, maybe have to step up, and not that the guys didn't do well enough, but it's one of those things where you lose one or two games, and it was really hard. It was a really hard rut to get out of, if you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, in the end, we were able to win that last game after, I think it was losing six or seven games on the bounce, which was obviously not a good thing. And that for me just shows the side of things that happened this year, because obviously it is a developing team, and it is, guys are coming and going constantly. It's, we never have a very consistent lineup. So, I think that's how it's always going to be, because that's the purpose of the team. So, but on the whole, it's not ended out too bad in the end.
Well, and obviously you were coming off such a long losing streak. How was it in the dressing room, knowing you still controlled your destiny on Saturday night against Bethlehem Steel? Like, how easy was it to get people up for the game, and what was your role as the elder statesman in the locker room?
Well, to be honest, I think it was one of those games where everybody knew what they had to do. Everybody knew that it was a must-win game. There wasn't a lot that really needed to be said in that respect, because they knew it was, win or go home type of scenario. And, it was it certainly wasn't pretty the way we did it. But in those situations, when it's like that, it was a game that we just needed to win. It didn't really matter how we did it. We just needed to win it. And thankfully we were able to go there and get a result. And I go back to the week before that. We played Cincinnati away in front of 24,000 fans. It was probably one of our best actual performances of the season. It was certainly up there in probably the top three performances we've had this season. And we come away with a 1-0 loss that we certainly didn't feel like we deserved. And then the next week we go to Bethlehem, don't play well at all, and come away with a 2-0 victory. So, that just sums up the game of fuck up for you in a nutshell, really. That's just how it goes sometimes.
Well, it was. I have to say, I'd never seen Bethlehem's Field before, but it's in a just a gorgeous part of the country. It was really interesting to watch on TV from just the setting of it. But as you mentioned, the team didn't actually play all that well. They finally sort of against the run of play got a ball forward to Michael Cox, who pushed it over to Mendoza for an easy goal. How much pressure did that take off the team? You know, in the early going, having that lead, knowing you needed 3 points to advance.
It did take a lot of pressure off the team. I think once we got that goal, obviously, you'd like to think that it would have settled us down and we were able to get some sort of rhythm of play, but unfortunately, that didn't work out like that. We ended up defending, you know, for pretty long periods during that first half, and I almost look back at it now and think maybe obviously, we're winning, so you can't say that too much, but the odds maybe ended up hindering us a little bit scoring so early, if you understand what I'm saying, because we almost sat back a little bit too much then and didn't really, like I say, get into a rhythm and try and play, you know, try and play our football and keep the ball a little bit better. But again, I mean, you know, we look back and we analyse it as we have done this week since we've been back in, and at the end of the day, we, you know, it was about getting the result, and we were able to bunker in, and you know, a team effort defensively, we ended up standing pretty stout in the end. All right, they had one or two decent looks, but I mean, every team in every game does, unfortunately, but we're able to hang in there.
Well, and obviously we mentioned one guy, which was Michael Cox. He's been great for this team. 11 goals, 3 assists. How great has he been just having somebody who's been so dependable this year?
Yeah, he's been good, Coxie. I've been impressed with him. We give him a little bit of stick because he's not one of the best trainers, as I would like to say. On a daily basis in training, he's not always the best in that, but in games he turns up and he puts himself about. He's a big, strong guy, and you know, like you just said there, he's done fantastic for us this year, and he's certainly one to keep a little bit of an eye out for in the future. Maybe, hopefully, you know, at some point he may get a bit of a chance because you know, he's got pace, he's got strength, he can hold the ball up, and he can finish pretty well. So he's certainly got a lot of attributes going for him. So you know, you never know with that one.
You know, Lewis, before we turn our attention forward to New York Red Bulls 2, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the goal that sealed the win on Sunday, the goal that you had, actually.
I'd be disappointed if you didn't mention it, to be honest.
Yeah, you've had some really big goals for the team, and you know, and it's in its first incarnation in USL, obviously, and this one was a big goal. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your decision not only to shoot when you did, but what you thought on the play, what you saw, how it kind of unfolded for you.
I just remember the ball back. I think Pierre de Silva got a little touch on it somehow. It was a bit of a, you know, 50-50 in the middle of the field there, and Pierre de Silva just getting a touch on it, and I remember just obviously reading where it was going, and obviously as it's bounced, I sort of like took a little touch off my chest, and as it sat down for me, it's one of them where it sat perfectly in my stride. I didn't have to really, you know, break my stride or do anything particular with the ball. It was just there to hit. I remember seeing the keeper was—he was a little bit off his line. I just thought, right, I'm going to give this a bash and just smash it with the laces and hope for the best. Really, I guess you just hope that you get a good connection. The technique was pretty good on it, and you know, if your technique's right, then you know you plan on just trying to hit the target, and that's what I did. And thankfully, it went into that top left-hand corner, so it was a great feeling, and obviously that then relieved them a lot of the pressure. Then going 2-0 up, and you know, we just needed to hang in there for that final whistle, and we did, thankfully.
And so obviously we've now made it to the playoffs. How have you guys gone about preparing for such a dominant New York Red Bulls 2 team that almost doubled us in points, and you know, they don't have the best stadium atmosphere, attendance is usually pretty low, so you've maybe got that on your side, but how are you going to approach this game on Sunday?
Yeah, well, we've been working on our tactical shape you know, a bit this week so far. We'll obviously we have a couple more days until the game, so we'll continue to do that. We've pretty much worked as a normal week, as if it was a normal game. Obviously I know there's the added pressure of it being a playoff game, but I think you know, Coach Anthony Pulis and Rob Valentino have tried to, you know, try to keep everybody pretty calm and just do everything, you know, prepare for a game as we have done for the majority of the season. So I mean, it's another one of them where, you know, you don't really need to tell the guys in the group and those that, you know, everybody knows it's a massive game. It's a one-off playoff game. Anything can happen. Yes, they have been dominant and they are a very good team. And, rightly so, they're going to be the favourites of the game and we're going to be underdogs. But I quite like that, to be honest. I think, if we can quietly go about our business and keep a pretty solid shape early on in that game and try and keep them off the scoreboard for as long as we can. You know, you never know what can happen in playoff soccer, should I say. So we're looking forward to it.
And when New York Red Bulls 2 came to Melbourne, you know, you guys were able to get a good result out of that game. It didn't go quite so well at Red Bull Arena. It's a team that I think that in a lot of ways Orlando City would like Orlando City B to be, where a lot of academy guys are coming up and a lot of talent is able to be, basically able to put it there because their MLS side is so deep. But with that big lopsided loss at Red Bull Arena earlier, there's going to be maybe some concerned players going in there about whether they can stay in that game. But I think one player that maybe is feeling pretty confident after last week's game is Zach Hayden, who really did a good job on Eric Ayuk, a guy with world-class speed and who's played, has some MLS pedigree. Tell a little bit about, Zach and not just Zach on the one side, but the fullbacks in general, because that seems to be a strength of Orlando City B.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Zach's an excellent 1v1 defender. There's not too many guys that get around him in 1v1 situations. On the ball, he needs to maybe improve just a little bit in terms of his because obviously fullbacks these days need to be able to get up and down. They need to be able to combine and get forward and play crosses. So that's one side of the game. But defensively, 1v1, he's excellent in those situations, and it was a real plus that he was able to perform the way he did against, obviously, like you say, such a very quick and very, very positive forward thinking player like Eric Ayuk. We just need to really focus on us. Yes, they did thump us 5-1 away, but we did go down to 9 men. So that obviously didn't help. They had the video refereeing situation down there that got a guy of ours sent off early on, which we thought we were pretty hard done to in the end when Connor Donovan got sent off. But go back to the game when we played at Melbourne, we drew 2-2 with them. We actually played really well. First half, we actually played them off the park. We just had two really, really bad set-piece plays that we gave two goals upon. But apart from that, we were... I keep referring back to the guys to, not forget the 5-1, because obviously that's something that can motivate you, because you certainly don't want that to happen again. And it's not a nice feeling sitting in that dressing room after a 5-1 defeat. So that's something that I like to, quietly remind them about, but then also remind them of the performance that we gave at Melbourne, because that 2-2 was very, very good. We were excellent that day. We're certainly going to need to be at that level, if not very close to that level, to get a result out of this playoff game.
Well, and obviously the organization's goal was to make the playoffs at the start of the season. You've done that. How has Anthony Pulis done as a first-year head coach?
Yeah, I think I've been really, really impressed with how he's handled and dealt with everything that's been thrown at him. He's very detailed in his approach to his coaching method. There's not a stone left unturned when he's preparing us for a game. We know all about the opposition. We know what's expected of us on that pitch. And I've been really impressed with him. And obviously, this is all in his first year as a head coach, and I'm sure that's only going to get better with the more experience that he gains.
Well, Lewis, before we let you go, just wanted one final question. Orlando City B did a great job of just hanging around, and finally, through all those, the bad run of results, finally broke through and made it into the postseason. Is there anything that, you can sort of transfer to the senior team in terms of hang in there, keep doing what you're doing, that kind of thing, to have them maybe have that similar run at the end, and maybe Orlando City could also make the playoffs this year?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, you until you're mathematically unable to make the playoffs, you keep going, you keep working your socks off, you get your head down, and you keep grinding until you mathematically can't make it. And the new coaching staff have been very, they're very, very positive in everything that they do, and I'm sure they'll only continue to be positive after the clean sheet that they kept last night. There's three games to go. For me, from what I've seen of the table and the standings and the points difference, that they need to you need to win at least two of their the last three games, and two of those are at home. So, it's certainly not an impossible task. Yes, it doesn't look too great in terms of the table, but I know everybody will be trying to be kept positive, and like I say, until they physically can't make it into the playoffs, then they'll keep grinding and grafting away until that's the case. And that'll be something that I'll be saying to them too, because like I say, it's certainly not doable in terms of making it for the playoffs.
Well, Lewis Neal, we appreciate you being with us on the Mainland Podcast this week. And, of course, we wish you the best of luck in the playoffs against New York Red Bulls, too, and hopefully beyond. And, Lewis Neal, Orlando City player, Orlando City B player, broadcaster, sort of a jack of all trades. Thanks so much for being with us.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The Mainland Podcast, episode number 67, is winding down, and we're just a few minutes away from the end of yet another award-winning podcast. But we want to thank Lewis Neal for coming by this week. We know it's a very busy week for him and for his Orlando City B teammates, and hopefully Lewis can captain his team to a playoff victory against New York Red Bulls 2 and shock the world and knock out that number one seed on Sunday in Harrison, New Jersey. A city that I'm told is not actually named after you, Andrew Harrison.
It is not, no. I feel like my ancestors did not get here in time. But we also have picked something a little more picturesque, like Southern Pennsylvania, if we were interested.
Well, let's turn our attention to Orlando City against Montreal Impact. And the Lions have done quite well against the Montreal Impact, not only throughout last year, but this year as well. I thought that, you can't really do much better than what they did at Montreal. In fact, that's the last victory that this team has. A 4-1 win in Montreal. And just think how good we felt about Orlando City after that win, because they're coming off wins, back-to-back wins, for only the second time all year. They had beaten New York City FC at home, went to Montreal, and got the win on the road there, which that was the first win at Montreal. And they even had Drogba in the lineup for that. Then the kind of the ceiling caved in a little bit since then.
The sky's falling, Chicken Little.
Exactly. So, Andrew, what's your take on this team, and how do you what's the key matchup for Sunday, and what's your final score prediction?
This is going to be an interesting one. Obviously, we're in the thick of it. I think both teams are playing three games in 9 days. There's going to be a lot of tired bodies on there. The depth is going to be very interesting going forward. My take on it is Drogba is playing for the Impact right now, but he's not really playing as Drogba can do. He seems a little fed up with the challenge, I feel like, right now. He did play pretty well the other day against San Jose, but he's not the Drogba that we saw come into this league last year and propel Montreal so far up the table. Matchups, I think it still has to be keeping him quiet. He peppered Joe Bendick's goal up in Montreal. If Joe doesn't have his Wheaties that morning, we probably don't leave 4-1. It's probably an entertaining 5-all draw. so I'm going to say that it's got to be the back line that is just, I know we didn't leak goals the other day, but we're not playing cohesively. If Drogba can get behind there when he's supported by Piatti, he's going to be really dangerous. Aya and Mateos are just going to have to really spend all of their time keeping him quiet. And maybe I would also like to mention, if we go with that diamond, whoever's got that base is going to have to spend 95% of the game keeping Piatti quiet and breaking that link down. But also not then forgetting Aduro, who's also going to be streaking around and trying to make some difficulties. I want to be positive because I know that we need a win. I just, with Brekshay being missing, we're going to see a change again. I don't see a positive result from this one, and I am actually going to say Montreal wins 3-1.
Whoa, all right, okay, so
and
that's pretty pessimistic.
And my goal scorer, just as a thing, I'm probably going to think that Kaká gets one off a free kick.
All right, well, that would be nice because there have been precious few set-piece goals this year.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a little more optimistic than you. I'm going to say that this team is going to... well, first of all, my key matchup is the central midfield against Piatti. They absolutely have to protect the back line from Piatti. I thought they did a good job of that in Montreal for the most part. I thought they really did a good job. In fact, I thought Alston did a good job in that game against Piatti. But... you know, they have been prone to breaking down. I want to see more control. I want to see somebody in Piatti's face the way that Bradley was in Kaká's face this past week. And I think that if they can manage that, Orlando City can win this game 2-1. If Drogba plays on the turf, it might be a 2-2 draw.
Okay.
Because he could just produce a moment of magic from the numerous free kicks that we give up around the box. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that will be difficult to get that win if Drogba plays on the AstroTurf. And we think because of the fact that they're in the middle of a thick, heavy playoff chase, maybe if they were higher up the table like they were earlier in the year, he wouldn't play in this game. But I think you almost have to expect him to come in at some point, maybe as a second half sub, or maybe he starts and goes 60 minutes, something like that.
Yeah. It's such a matchup because you don't know. We don't know which Orlando City we're going to get. I mean, we went into Montreal thinking, oh, it's going to be really difficult. And, you know, we concede in the first minute and we're just like, oh, this is just going to be an utter collapse. And then we pull out probably one of the best performances of the season from the Carlos Rivas that we didn't know we owned.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what we're going to get. I just feel that this team is so beaten up that, regardless of the Montreal that shows up, we're going to have a big crowd. People are going to come in, but it is a day game. It's probably going to be hot. It's going to be humid, and it's just going to be very interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because this game will tell us whether there's hope or not. if the team loses or even draws this game, there's just no.
Oh yeah, it's out.
Even if they're mathematically still in it, they're really not in it. They have to get the 3 points, and they probably also need some help with whoever DC's playing this weekend. It escapes me at the moment, but it's a game where I think this might be an interesting start for Jason Kreis. I think Jason Kreis to win Carlos Rivas over may choose to start him again over Lahren because. You know, because not only because he needs to win him back, but also because Carlos Rivas played pretty darn well against Montreal the last time.
Yeah, and you also kind of have to reward him for taking him off in the 40th minute against Toronto. And you have to tell him that it wasn't him. But that's also kind of what I want to see from Jason Kreis is that if he knows that a system or a player plays really well against that team, why not give it a go? At this point, we really don't have anything to lose. Our mathematical percentage of making the playoffs is below 10%, I think, at this point. We just got to throw him on and see what happens. And, okay, we haven't given 4 weeks to tell him that he's going to start this game and that he knows he's going to be playing. But you got to reward him. You've got to show him that he can go out and be that player that you need. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, Lahren, as much as he didn't hit a sophomore slump, he's still bagged 14 this year. He's tired. He is a young, tired 21-year-old that is unfortunately sick of supporting this franchise like Atlas. And so you need another body to be able to come in. And maybe it's Rivas. And if you give him that reward, that if you risk him, you may get a great reward.
You may. I think the part of the problem for me with Laren the last few games is he's not being rewarded for the runs he's making. I think that the attacking midfielders have not done enough to get him the ball. There was a break in the game at Toronto where Orlando City had a counterattack going, and it was a 3v3, and it ended up being a 4v3, and Kaká had the ball in the middle, and Laren made a run to split the two defenders, and I thought, here's a goal. And Kaká chose instead to pass the ball to Breck Shea on the right and use Laren's run as a decoy, which, again, you know, that's he's pulling the strings. That's his call to make, and he decided to make that call, and you know, it's hard to argue with it. Laren's going to draw some attention. Maybe I give the ball to Breck. Laren takes the defenders with him and, you know, opens up the space. In fact, what happened was Shea decided to give the ball to a late running Molino, who by that point drew the attention of the defenders who laid off of Laren, who was now offside, and Molino had nothing he could do but try to backheel it back to Breck, and it went horribly wrong. So that was a case where I think, again, the team's not getting the ball to Laren, so Laren's not effective. In those few moments that maybe he can make that difference, they're not helping him make that difference. So it's not all on Kyle, and it's not all just because he's tired, because, you know, it's a long season for everybody. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how many minutes you're getting. There's guys in the league with a lot more minutes probably than him. But it's also it's a mental thing too, late in games when you're not getting the ball.
Yeah.
And he was not if you're not getting him the ball, he can't score goals. Scott wrote about that recently. It's like if you get him more touches, his goals per touch is very high. It's among the highest in the league. But we're not getting him those touches. So it's a double-edged sword because he's not the dynamic quick ball movement type of guy the way that Kaká and Molino and MPG are, so it's kind of hard for him to play off of them. He needs to just make the run and have them feed him.
Yeah.
And that just hasn't been happening. And I think, you know, credit to the opponents who are aware that that's what he needs and they're taking that away. You know, it would be interesting to see Carlos Rivas in that role. I like that you brought up the fact that, you know, a coach should do something that's been successful in the past until the other team proves they can stop it. That's kind of what a beef that I had with Adrian Heath earlier this year when Orlando City went to visit the Red Bulls, because Carlos Rivas ate them alive last year on the left wing. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even put him in the 18, I don't believe, in that game. And then I think Bobby Murphy may have been the coach the second time he went to Red Bull Arena. And again, you know, didn't use him that way. And I thought that if you just go back and look at that film and see how badly he destroyed them, you know, why wouldn't you try that again?
I agree. And I think that was Heath's biggest weakness, is that you have to be able. This is a game of soccer. You're not playing the same team week in, week out. We're all playing by the same game and the same rules, but you're coming up against a different 11 guys. And sometimes you need to be able to do that. As we've seen, Orlando City cannot play against the high press and be successful whatsoever. It's incapable of diffusing that as a situation. I think that what we saw with Montreal was they were just incapable of handling speed. Just as we were with a David Akam for Chicago, you occasionally have to put him in there. And even if he's not going to score you a lot of goals, he is going to terrorize you and pull that shape apart. And that's so important, because right now we're just not getting that. You know, you talk about Laren needing more touches. When we had Seren and Aguita, even though their final third ball was terrible, they were at least getting up the pitch. Since we've seen that transition away to really not allowing those people to move past the halfway line, his number of touches has gone way down, as is his number of shots, and therefore his number of goals. I think that when we see a return to the diamond formation, you'll eventually hopefully be able to see Laren's touches start to go back up, because there'll be a conduit to getting him the ball to make an attempt and hopefully bang it in the back of the net.
Yeah, and let's not forget that one of the best producers of passes to Kyle Laren last year was Carlos Rivas from that left side. I mean, he was – I would certainly be willing to say that from the left side, he is maybe one of the top five crossers of the ball in MLS right now. That's a bold statement for a guy who hardly plays, but I will stand by that. I think that his crossing ability to Laren has been proven time and time again. He has just put picture perfect passes on Laren's head, on his foot, and off of the defender and in. So, you know, I think you have to utilize those talents. And certainly I think Adrian Heath pretty much gave up on Carlos Rivas, but, if there's anything there, we need to know now because, or move on, because that DP slot is just too valuable to sit there and waste on a player who's not regularly playing.
Yeah, and I mean we've already used up the wasted DP slot with Rochez, who's playing for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then also MPG is technically a DP. So you're either going to have to buy him down with allocation money, you're going to have to trade more draft picks away for another international slot. There's a lot going on for this team this year, and obviously we're way down the allocation order, and we're about to get even further behind with two new teams coming in. We're going to have to uncover some talent, but limited draft picks, we're going to have to go out and really raid the other teams and see what we can do. I expect, once again, I think we're going to see a big turnover for this mm-hmm. team, not just because of the performance, but we also need a complete, at least maybe 10 new guys to be able to play the system that we know that Jason Christ prefers.
Well, we'll definitely see some changes because of the shape change, or because of what Jason likes to do tactically. 10 is a lot. 10 is a lot of changes. We'll see what happens. But first, we'll see what happens on Sunday against Montreal Impact. Go ahead.
I think the problem is you just look at the roster and you think you're probably shipping Bowden. You're probably shipping Alston. You've got some young guys who probably you could drop down to OCB on permanent loan outs. You're going to have to go out and get other people, and you're going to have to ship some of your big contracts. We can't keep them. And you already talk about, you know, your two guys, you're probably already shipping Rochez, Rivas, Bowden. I imagine you ship Alston if Ramos comes back healthy. Do you keep Edwards, or do you try to go out to find somebody else? It's pretty easy to start to get to 10 when you start boiling it down.
Yeah, maybe so. I think Edwards is a cheap guy, though, that you can stash as a second keeper. As long as nothing happens to Bendick, I think you're in pretty good shape with Edwards as your backup. But we've got plenty of time to dissect that in the offseason, and we will. We will. So we'll see what happens against Montreal on Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock game in the hot Florida sun. Hopefully those Canadians will come down here and those snowbirds will wilt and allow the Lions to take away 3 points for the first time in forever. And we'll see what happens. In the meantime, please visit us at themainland.com. Follow us on Twitter at themainland, Maine, like a lion's mane, not like Main Street, M-A-N-E. Also, you can please like us on Facebook and leave us a lovely, thoughtful, nice review on iTunes, and we would really appreciate that. So that'll just about wrap it up. Number 67, episode 67 in the books. And we'll be back next week to talk about the Montreal match and look ahead to an international break, actually. A week off where the men's national team will be playing. We'll have a week off. And then the final two matches of the season will both be on the next two Sundays after that. Which will be at Philadelphia and then home against DC United. Hopefully that DC United match will have a lot of playoff ramifications when it arrives. But we'll get into it next week. And we would like to thank again our guest, Lewis Neal, for stopping by and wish him luck this weekend at New York Red Bulls 2. On behalf of Andrew Harrison, senior columnist at themainland.com, I am Michael Citro, the managing editor, signing off saying, Go City!